there. Okay. Books over here in the back. If you don't have a book, Brother Calvert got some for us. So if you need one, I guess you can go ahead and raise your hand. It looks like he's making his way there. One, two, three, four over there. One here in the back. I don't know about Mr. Richter, but I'm sticking pretty closely to the book and to the biblical text. I'm sure you're probably doing the same thing. Of course, he's had many more years of teaching this than I have. But in preparing for these lessons, at least when I'm teaching on Sundays, if you go through the book, you'll be right along with what I'm going to be going over for the most part. All right, so those of you who maybe weren't here last Sunday when I was teaching, we just did a brief review, kind of catching us up to this time period that we're covering of the captivity return and the years of silence. And then on Wednesday, we kind of caught back up there, went through a little bit more of that time period. And then we got into Daniel. Daniel falling into this time of captivity when he's prophesying for these 70 years. Daniel, and we'll go over this again tonight or this morning, but Daniel was taken with that first wave of captives. And so we see Daniel prophesying within that 70 years and his prophecies stretching out throughout that entire time period. And so we're going to pick up in Daniel chapter 3 today. And that's what we'll be looking at. The story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego before the image of gold that Nebuchadnezzar erects. I don't have this TV on. I don't know. I mean, it's not a huge deal. I can turn around, but... All right, so Daniel chapter 3, the last story that we see mentioning Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. If you turn back to chapter 1, and we went over this on Wednesday, but we looked at verses 6 and 7 introducing Daniel, Hananiah, and Mishael, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, which were the Hebrew names for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And of course, when they got to Babylon, they were given these names that represented actually Babylonian gods. These names, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, were Hebrew names that represented the name of God within their interpretation. But when they came to Babylon, they were given names that represented the names of Baal, of Babylonian gods. So that's just an interesting note. But we see them first mentioned here in Daniel chapter 1, verse 7. And then we see them also mentioned in verses 11 through 13 when we're talking about Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego abstaining from the foods and the wine and the diet, basically, that they were given, and how they grew stronger in verses 17 through 20 than all the other young men that were in Babylon at this time, becoming experts in Babylonian ways. They grew stronger. And then we see them again mentioned in chapter 2, verse 17, when Daniel is going to interpret the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. And he meets up with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Of course, in chapter 2, it mentions their Hebrew names, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And they pray together with Daniel. And then Daniel interprets the dream at the end of the chapter. And then we see them mentioned again in verse 49 of chapter 2. After Daniel interprets this dream of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar praises the God of Daniel, and he says in verse 47, "True that your God is a God of gods, a Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." So he promotes Daniel, and then Daniel, asks for the promotion of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So he puts them over the affairs of the provinces, or of the province of Babylon. And then we see Daniel sitting in the gate of the king in verse 49. So we transition, we see this transition in verse 49 from focusing on Daniel in chapter 2 to focusing now on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Where are we at? This is the last story, as I have up here, that we see mentioning these three men. There's a question as to when this story did occur. It's not a it's not of huge significance as to when it did occur. Not entirely sure when it did occur. It is possible and it's logical for us to assume that it occurred shortly after the events of chapter 2. Bob Waldron mentions in his book how some have tried to reconcile this story with Jeremiah chapter 52, verses 28 through 29, talking about Nebuchadnezzar's captives, and the Septuagint and the Theodotion translation, which is another translation of the Hebrew text, really kind of lean towards this interpretation of this story. But again, there's not a lot of evidence to really support that in the text. Again, that's not really of any certain significance or consequence for us in interpretation of the passage itself, but just a tidbit of information as far as following this story and where it lies chronologically. All right, so let's get into the text of Daniel chapter 3. So we see in verse 1, really verses 1 through 7, we kind of see the stage set. Daniel erecting this large golden image in verse 1. His height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. So in our measurements for us today, it'd be 90 feet high and 9 feet wide. Now that actually, when I was doing a little research to see what statue might compare to this, let's see if I can pull it up here. This is the statue of the Virgin Mary. It's called Our Lady of the Rockies. It's in Montana. This statue is 90 feet high, and I'll show you here. Make sure this is working. Okay. That's like trucks down there. Okay. And that's a fence surrounding the statue. So you can see kind of at least the height of the statue that we're talking about. Now that looks much wider than 9 feet. And again, as I was looking at this, I was thinking, I wonder how that statue even stood up at 9 feet wide and 90 feet high. But still, nonetheless, Nebuchadnezzar erected this 90-foot golden image. And he brings all of his people, the satraps, the administrators, the governors, counselors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, so all these high officials. And then, of course, we see in verse 2, the officials of the provinces. Who would fall under that category, according to chapter 2 and verse 49? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So here they are. They've had this promotion at the end of chapter 2. And now they fall into this sticky situation in which now they are a part of these officials that are supposed to be a part of this dedication of this image that Nebuchadnezzar erects in the plains of Dura. I didn't mention that, that little detail, which is just a part of a plain within Babylon. As far as to its specific location, not entirely sure. Of this building? Okay, so about three times the height of this building is what we're looking at as far as the height of this image. Would have been something pretty incredible. I don't know, this was another thing, and I think the Washington Monument is about 150 feet. So, you know, you can imagine just a little bit shorter than that. Still, really big image that we're talking about here. Okay. So we see him calling all of these officials in verse 2 to the dedication of this image that he has set up. And then it says in verse 4, then a herald cried aloud, To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, that you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. I think this is interesting. Verse 6, Nebuchadnezzar inciting these threats, or issuing these threats to incite obedience, worship of this golden image. Think about, too, the contrast of the worship of Jehovah and the worship of this image. Willful obedience to God. In the dedication of the temple, in their yearly sacrifices, willfully obeying God, not having this threat against them, of course, must be done in fear and reverence towards God, but not having this threat incited against them. But Nebuchadnezzar having to incite these threats, or feeling like he has to incite these threats, or to issue these threats to get these people to obey and worshiping this image. I think it's just an interesting contrast between the worship of Jehovah and the worship of this image. And I'm sure there's more contrast that we might be able to bring out between that. But here are Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, people who were once worshiping Jehovah, now being forced to worship this golden image. Worshiping Jehovah freely, I might add. This is just a little bit of practical application that I hadn't thought of until now. But it is a very real possibility that we, as Christians, might face the exact same situation as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. At one time, freely worshiping our God as we are today, and then all of a sudden we find ourselves in a position where we are being issued threats to do or say or worship, even worship, a certain thing. Just a good thought for us to think about as we go on throughout the story and see how Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego respond to this threat of worshiping the image that Nebuchadnezzar has set up. So they begin playing this symphony, as he describes it in verse 7, with all kinds of music. All the people, nations and languages fell down and worshiped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Moving into verses 8 through 18, where we really see the response of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and how they respond to this threat. Verse 8 says, therefore at that time certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods of worship, or serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. Sounds a lot like the situation that we are going to find a little bit later on with Daniel. And when Daniel is praying to his God and they issue this decree so that they can catch him. Not quite the same. These men did not issue this decree to catch Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as far as we know it. But, again, catching Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, possibly even out of jealousy because of their elevation, of their promotion that we saw in chapter 2. We see these Chaldeans telling on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego because of their refusal to serve Nebuchadnezzar's gods and bow down to this image that he set up. Right. Out of spite, yeah, absolutely. So we see Nebuchadnezzar's response, which is not out of character for Nebuchadnezzar. And I'll say this is something that as I've been studying this and as we've been studying it on Wednesday, and I was studying for this lesson today, that I had not never noticed about Nebuchadnezzar as far as his character goes. But we do see this kind of as a theme within Nebuchadnezzar's life as we know it. In verse 13. Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. Not uncharacteristic of Nebuchadnezzar, is it? In chapter 2, when he has this dream, and he's trying to get these people, his wise men, to interpret for him, and he wants them to tell them the dream that he's had, and they can't do it. And then he issues this very harsh decree that he's just going to kill everybody. Again, we kind of see the character of Nebuchadnezzar coming out in each of these stories. Just very impulsive, almost a rage monster, it seems like, from Nebuchadnezzar. So he brings Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego before him. And then he asks them very pointedly in verse 14, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? He gives them an opportunity in verse 15 to worship this image. He says, if you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? What seems ironic to you, especially if we're looking at this story being immediately after the events of chapter 2, what's ironic about Nebuchadnezzar asking the question that he asks in verse 15? Who is the God that will deliver you from my hands? Right. There was obviously a connection between Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and the God who had interpreted their dreams, because Daniel was the one that interpreted the dreams and asked for the promotion of his friends. Nebuchadnezzar had met these people, met these men. You remember he had interviews with each of them in chapter 1. So he knew who Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were. He knew the God that they worshipped. And he even said in chapter 2, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. Nebuchadnezzar knew exactly who the God was that could deliver them from his hand. Right, that's a good point too. And Bob makes that point in his book, is towards the end of this story, and when he's telling the story in the book, is that God has a lot to prove to Nebuchadnezzar, right? Because now Nebuchadnezzar thinks that he's one-upped the God of Israel. He's desecrated his temple, he's taken the items from his temple for his own, he's destroyed his city. Nebuchadnezzar has really, in his mind, no reason to fear the God of Israel. But God has a thing or two to show him about that, right? So he showed him something already in chapter 2, and then Nebuchadnezzar acknowledges that in chapter 2, but still lacks fear for Jehovah in verse 15. Right. Right. And we'll see that again. Even after this story, we see that again in chapter 4 when, I believe it's chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar being turned into a beast of the field, still lacking that fear of God in action, right? Even though he might acknowledge these facts about God, still lacking that fear in his humility and obedience. Okay, so verse 16, we see the response of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They answered the king, they answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." I think it's pretty neat to see the reaction of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and how they boldly answer Nebuchadnezzar and say, "We don't have to answer you in this matter." It's a lot of boldness from Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, especially after having been promoted. A lot of boldness in answering Nebuchadnezzar this way. "We don't have to answer you in this, but if this is the case that we're going to be thrown into this fiery furnace, we're still not going to serve your gods or bow down before this image." Right, a decisive moment of we're either serving Nebuchadnezzar or God right here, and we've made our choice. Right. Right. Verse that comes to mind, Matthew chapter 10, verse 28, which we're all very familiar with this verse. But in Matthew chapter 10, verse 28, Jesus said, "Do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." We see that fear of Jehovah, right, from Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego here in this verse and how they respond to Nebuchadnezzar. Moving into, notice this verse before we move into the next section, verse 17. A couple things that they state their trust in God to, one, deliver them from the furnace, the punishment that Nebuchadnezzar said that he was going to, enact. And two, the very hand of the king, right? When Nebuchadnezzar very specifically, said, "Who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" They say very specifically and very explicitly in verse 17, "He will deliver us from your hand. This is the God that will deliver us from your hand." Go ahead. Right. That's a good point. Right. Yeah, in spite of what might happen or not, which we see in verse 18, right? They say, "If not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." So there was no certain knowledge, like you're saying, as to whether or not they were going to be delivered from this fiery furnace, which again is another statement to the courage of Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, and that they were willing to suffer the consequences of submitting to and obeying Jehovah rather than man, which is what we read in Matthew chapter 10, verse 28. Being willing to suffer those consequences, knowing all along that God is able to deliver us, but whether or not he does, again, it is really should really be of no consequence to us. We're still going to serve God. We're still going to face the consequences for that, whatever they may be. Right. And they knew this was coming, right? They knew the warning. They knew what was being threatened against them, according to the verses earlier in the chapter. So again, we have to have that same resolve in our own lives. We see our country going in a very negative direction. So should be of no surprise to us that if it ends up at one point where we are threatened for our worship to God, we've got to make up our minds. We've got to be willing and be at peace with suffering the consequences of worshiping God. Go ahead, Oscar. Right. Still showing that confidence, suffering the consequences, and still, even after the consequences are enacted, having joy in that. Okay, so let's move on. We don't have a whole lot of time, to cover this, the rest of this, so let's move on from this. Verses 19 through 25, we see Nebuchadnezzar enacting this punishment that he had threatened. Verse 19, Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury. We saw that rage and fury that he exhibited in verse 13. And full of fury in verse 19 commands, it says his expression on his face changed. I think that's an interesting statement about Nebuchadnezzar's attitude toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego changing towards them. And then he commands that the furnace be heated seven times than how it's normally heated, and to cast Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into this furnace. It says that in verse 21, they bound them hand and foot, or bound them by their coat, trousers, turbans, and garments, and they were cast in the midst of this fiery furnace. And then those mighty men of valor that it described in verse 20, they were even killed because the king's command was so urgent, and the furnace was exceedingly hot. It killed these men as they were casting Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into the furnace. I did want to point this out in verse 22. This is the second time we have seen an quote unquote urgent command from Nebuchadnezzar, costing the lives of other people. And we saw that in chapter 2, in verses 12 through 13. What was going on? The king was very angry and very furious. And it says, he gave command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. And in verse, 15, Daniel says, why is the decree from the king so urgent? Another interpretation of that word urgent would be harsh. Why is King Nebuchadnezzar's commandment so harsh? Killing all of these wise men. Why is it so harsh that he's commanding that this furnace be heated seven times than what it normally is? I suppose there are some practical applications we could get from this. Again, not anything necessarily, I think, super expounds on the story itself, but possibly some practical applications on how we handle our anger. In fury and rage, making these harsh commandments. That's how we see Nebuchadnezzar responding. And ultimately, again, it's costing other people their lives in his case. But I just thought that was an interesting point to note about the urgency or the harshness of Nebuchadnezzar, which again reveals the character that he had. Perfect verse to explain that. The wrath of man not producing the righteousness of God is what Mr. Klein was saying. We don't see Nebuchadnezzar, again, doing right when he's acting out of anger here. Okay, so we see them cast into this fiery furnace, been heated seven times in its normal heat. And then we see in verse 24, King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. And he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." "Look," he answered, "I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." So again, this furnace being heated up seven times, even killing the people that threw them in there. And Nebuchadnezzar is astonished at the fact that he sees these men unbound, walking around in the midst of this fire. And then he sees a fourth like the Son of God, or other translations might say a son of the gods. Possibly a supernatural being is what Nebuchadnezzar is describing here. Somebody mighty, something supernatural here going on. Beyond that, I personally don't know of any other interpretation. Does anybody know of anything else? To me, that seems like the only logical thing. Nebuchadnezzar describing some kind of supernatural being in the midst of this fire with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Right. Right. And it seems like he just sees this form, right, of people. But obviously there was something about this fourth thing that was supernatural, something great about this, whatever it was. It would be interesting to know what it was. But anyway, so we see this see Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego being unharmed by the fire. In verse 26, Nebuchadnezzar goes near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and says, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of fire. And the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. You think about being at a bonfire. I'm sure most of us have been at a bonfire before. And you stand kind of near that fire, and your face starts getting leathery almost, and you start feeling that extreme heat. Eventually, after a few seconds, you can hardly even look towards it. At least that's how I am. I imagine that that helps me at least make the story real. That's just a bonfire. You can imagine, again, this fire being exceedingly hot due to the rage of Nebuchadnezzar, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego being cast into this fire, and Nebuchadnezzar just coming near the mouth of it to call to them. And they walk out of this extremely hot fire to answer Nebuchadnezzar, untouched, don't even have the smell of fire on them. Pretty incredible thought. Right, yeah, that's another good point. We don't see that son of the gods or the Son of God coming out with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Good point to mention. All right, so Nebuchadnezzar sees this great thing that the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego has done. And once again, Nebuchadnezzar is convicted of the power of Jehovah. Again, we saw that in chapter 2, verse 47. We read that earlier. But he says, "Blessed be the God," in verse 28, "of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God." Yielding their own bodies, giving up their life to honor Jehovah. Verse 29, "Therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this." Another harsh decree from Nebuchadnezzar. He sees, again, enacting this disobedience for the God that he is forcing the people to serve. He sees the power of Jehovah and then enacts another harsh decree. These people, whoever disobeys God is going to be cut in pieces and their houses shall be made into an ash heap. Again, I think it's kind of ironic. here. But so far, Nebuchadnezzar has seen God's wisdom, being able to reveal the dreams, as he said in chapter 2 and verse 47. And then now he has seen God's ability to deliver from destruction and earthly authority from his hand. Right. Right. We see Daniel facing essentially the same thing under, it's not Nebuchadnezzar ruling, it'd be Darius, but we will see Daniel facing the same kind of trial later. And then, of course, as we all know, he remains faithful as well. The great irony, I think, possibly of among a few other ironies in this story, which would be the harshness of his decree, the fact that they were saved. Another great irony to me is verse 30, that the story ends with another promotion of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They've been promoted at the end of chapter 2. They go through all this in chapter 3. And again, they're promoted in the kingdom. Just another wonderful irony that God is, and we see that all throughout Scripture, God using situations, total irony of it is pretty, I think, pretty comical in some ways. Right. Right. So, those of you who didn't hear him, we see God's providence working on behalf of these men, and then Nebuchadnezzar learning what true loyalty means. Loyalty, you know, not because he had to issue a threat to worship, but rather in spite of the threat, they were going to continue to serve Jehovah. Okay. Anything else that anybody wants to say regarding chapter 3? We're going to kind of move on. Go ahead. Right, that actually the love of Jesus, greater love has no man than to lay down his life for his friends. So totally opposite of what you're saying, you know, what the Muslims teach in regard to that. So yeah, it's an interesting point to note. The difference between dying for Christ and dying for what the Muslims call Allah, their God. Good point. Anything else on chapter 3? And we'll quickly go catch back up on our timeline here. Okay. I will say this, I forgot I had the slide. Just some important lessons from chapter 3. One, fearing God over fearing man, which we emphasize that in chapter 3, verse 16 and verse 18. Trusting in God, verse 17, in spite of the consequences, and then God's ability to deliver, acknowledging the fact that God can deliver. But also recognizing that he may not, and we're willing to suffer in spite of that. Okay. So we're gonna kind of introduce Ezekiel here in the next lesson. But I want us to kind of get caught up here and remember these dates, what we're talking about here as far as our timeline goes. So I'm gonna go through Judah first so that you know where we're at with the history of Judah, and then we'll go through Jeremiah and Ezekiel and see, Ezekiel, where Ezekiel falls within this timeline. So in 609 BC, we saw Jehoiakim rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. We saw that in 2 Kings chapter 24 in verse 1. In 601, we see the battle at Carchemish between Nebuchadnezzar and Egypt. And then we also see sometime, it's likely sometime within this time period, the raids against Judah, which are mentioned in 2 Kings chapter 24 and verse 2. So we saw the rebellion in verse 1, and we saw see these raids mentioned in verse 2, about roughly 8 years later after Jehoiakim's rebellion. In 597 BC, Nebuchadnezzar takes Jehoiachin and his family and officials captive. We have the verses up there that mention that. Nebuchadnezzar makes Zedekiah king as a vassal king, I believe is the term. Or a puppet king, you might say. 594 BC, it's the fourth year of Zedekiah's reign, which will be important for us introducing Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Zedekiah makes a trip to Babylon in Jeremiah chapter 51 and verse 59. In 593, we see the fifth year of Zedekiah's reign, 589. That's when the siege on Jerusalem begins. That would be the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign. Ezekiel 24 verses 1 through 2 mentions when that began, the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign. And then from the ninth year to the 11th year, Jerusalem was under siege from 589 to about 587 BC. Okay, so that's kind of where we're at with this timeline. So 609 Jehoiakim, 601 Carchemish. In 597, when Nebuchadnezzar takes Jehoiachin and his family and officials captive, Jeremiah had prophesied of this in Jeremiah chapter 22, verses 24 through 30. We also see the story of the good versus the bad figs, the people of Israel who thought that the ones who had not been taken captive thought that they were favored in God's eyes, and God saying, no, actually, you're going to be destroyed. Story in Jeremiah 24 verses 1 through 10. And then we see Ezekiel is taken in the second group of captives with Jehoiachin. Jehoiakim, Daniel went with them, right? And then with Jehoiachin, we see Ezekiel going into captivity. Esther chapter 2 verses 5 through 6, Bob mentions this in the book, pages 24 through 25. If you get a chance, look at that. It's just an interesting note regarding where this falls in the timeline. 597, we talked about how Nebuchadnezzar makes Zedekiah king in that year. Jeremiah writes a letter to the captives to settle down in Babylon because they're gonna be in captivity for 70 years. It's gonna last a while. The fourth year in 594 of Zedekiah's reign, Jeremiah warns against the false prophets who are going to speak, and we also see mentioned Ezekiel living among the captives in the river Chebar in that area where the common people were, and I showed that on the map on Sunday. We also see in this time period, or actually in the same chapter 28, when Jeremiah warns against these false prophets, Hananiah comes on the scene and speaks lies concerning the deliverance of the people, and he's punished for that and killed in that same year, if you remember that story. Zedekiah makes his trip to Babylon in Jeremiah 51, verse 59, and Jeremiah sends Sariah with Zedekiah to pronounce the judgment on Babylon when he goes to meet Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, I'm hurrying through this. In the fifth year of Zedekiah's reign, Ezekiel receives his call to be a prophet. In Ezekiel chapter 1 and verse 2, the siege on Jerusalem begins in 589, and the first 24 chapters of Ezekiel take place between this fifth year of Zedekiah and the ninth year, because in chapter 24 verses 1 through 2, that's when the siege on Jerusalem is mentioned in Ezekiel. So we can assume that chapters 1 through 24 take place within that time period, in the fifth year and the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign. Now that was kind of a whirlwind. But thank you for your attention. Thank you for your comments. Appreciate it.